Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, composer Bill Whelan reflects on 25 years of Riverdance, one of our finest writers, Dermot Bulger, on his new play, which tells the story of the old world of the Dublin docks, and we'll have some wonderful live music from the great Moya Brennan. A text number, 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Calvo. First up this morning, we have a competition for you, our listeners. We're giving away two tickets to see the fabulous Celine Dion in concert when she comes to Dublin next September. If you'd like to be in the audience, then answer this question. One of Celine's biggest and most loved songs is My Heart Will Go On. It featured in which film? Was it A, Titanic, B, the Jonathan Swift, or C, the Asgard? You can text in your answer and your name and address to 51551 and I'll read out the answer and the winners before the end of today's show. Well, first up this morning now, we are blessed to have in our studio Moya Brennan and her husband Tim and her children Paul and Aisling, and you're going to sing live for us. Yes. Moya, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Miriam.
I want to explain to my listeners, it's such a treat because in the Studio 10, you are here with your harp. Aisling is here with her bouzouki. Paul has a baron and Tim has a cello. Is this what your living room is like, normally?
sometimes.
So what are you going to sing first?
I'm going to sing a song that my grandmother gave me, Gran Dugan, and it's called Cranul.
Inta.
Thank you.
was beautiful, Moya. What a treat, isn't it? Just first thing in the morning. And your voice is so amazing.
Thank you.
To be able to sing at this hour of the morning.
Well, thank you very much.
And look, you're going to come back later on, because I know one of the things we're going to talk about is an event next Friday that you're very involved in, because you're the ambassador for CBM, which is all about fighting blindness. And it's a great concert in Christchurch Cathedral with Finbar Fury, Paul Byram, the African Gospel Choir and yourself. So we'll talk about that later on.
Okay.
All of you go off, get a cup of tea. And actually, Paul, your son, it's your birthday today. Happy birthday. We might have to sing happy birthday to him later on. Give him a shout out. Thanks a million. Speak to you all later on. Now I've been joined in studio by Dermot Bulger. Dermot Bulger, of course, is one of our finest novelists, playwrights and poets. Born in Finglas, his work is often about the experiences of working class characters who, for varying reasons, they feel slightly cut off from our society. And his latest play for the Abbey Theatre is about another working class community, this time based in the Dublin Docks. Good morning, Dermot. That was a treat, wasn't it, to give you that live music?
That was fabulous. It reminded me, I used to do visiting in the country. I bring my two sons.
Yeah.
And we used to call ourselves a fistful of Bulgers, two generations united by talent, divided by hair. And it's wonderful to see the music being passed on from generation to generation like that.
Yeah, it really is. Just to remind people, because I know your story, you grew up in Finglas, didn't you, Dermot? Remind people of your background.
Well, my father was a sailor. And my mother was from a family of 11 in Monaghan. They all emigrated apart from the uncle who got the farm. My father was from a family of seven in Wexford. They all emigrated for the uncle, except for the uncle who got the house in Wexford. People came back and forth. At times they mainly went to the places like the Vauxhall car plant and Luton and all those sort of places.
Yeah.
And my father, the only reason I have an Irish accent, unlike most of my relations, is that my father emigrated for 44 years as a sailor on those small Irish ships that sailed to Lisbon during the war, and then on the B&I and on the Dublin Gas Company. And he was, my memory of my father really is of an absence in my life. He's a registered envelope with crisp English banknotes arriving to my mother every Friday in the post, and sort of it was a lonely life being at sea. And I used to walk with him from Finglas Park down to a point on Clune Road, and he would disappear off to get two buses off to the Alexandra base and off to the world of the docks. And it was a world that I never understood, because it's hard to imagine Dublin now, but before the East Link Bridge was built. And just how cut off East Wall was and Ringsend was from the rest of the city in that sense of not being linked. And so writing Last Orders at the Dockside was when I was asked to do it. And Sammy Cahn, the great American songwriter, was once asked what came first, the music or the lyrics, and he said the phone call. And so when the phone call came to ask me to write this play, for me it was a chance to go follow my father through those gates all those years later, now that he's dead, alas, and actually relive the world of the dockers and the world of the sailors and the world of life on the Dublin Quays. And people know the Quays in the 40s and 50s because all the unloading happened right up to the customs house, and you would literally walk down the Quays and there'd be men would arrive every day. There were reeds which were like in Kilbourne. You'd arrive up, 100 men would arrive and 20 would be picked for work that day. But when I picked Last Orders at Dockside, it's 1980. It's the day that Johnny Logan wins the Eurovision, the night Johnny Logan wins the Eurovision.
Okay.
And it's sort of, at that stage, it has disappeared behind the walls of the Newport, and they're actually dumping rubbish from the bin trucks into the Dublin Bay to make more wharfs, and it's as if it's moving away from the city. And it was just a chance to explore a hidden world, and I've been exploring hidden walls since I was 18. I was doing it in Ballymun Tower Blocks and in sort of little monster arts festivals and things attended by two men and a dog when I was 18 and had hair. And it's lovely at the age of 60 and three quarters to finally do it on the Abbey stage.
And interesting, lots of people always say, I mean, the way you write about Dublin, Joseph O'Connor, for instance, said, Bulger is to Dublin what Dickens was to Victorian London. I mean, writing about the docks again, but you love writing about Dublin, don't you?
I just love, what I love about this play is that nowadays there's Facebook and the Twitter machine and all these things that I didn't have when I was younger. And you just like, I saw a picture of like four daughters of dockers outside the Abbey last night, tweeting. You see tweets of people writing about the play and then in memory of their fathers who were dockers and the whole community. And I actually love that you get little notes on the play, and there's a line in the play where someone says Johnny Logan's song is great, and someone says, no, it's a Shea Healy song. He he's from Sandymount. And Maisie in the play says, oh, he's a local, so, because Sandymount is only Ring's End with notions. And sometimes this gets a laugh, but actually it got a massive round of applause, didn't it? And I sort of knew there were more people from Ring's End and theatre than from Sandymount. And it's lovely that our national theatre is opening up to these stories of, and that people down the docks and people sort of who came from that world now feel a connection. This is a very small, incremental connection, but they're coming in. And I loved the other day I was in the Abbey. I didn't go to the play because I know how it ends myself, but I saw an elderly docker who's almost 80 with his son coming in, and maybe it was our first time ever in the Abbey, and they were 10 minutes picking their seats, and I just felt that was losing. Now maybe the play, there'd be more important plays, there'd be bigger plays, there'd be better plays, but I just felt this was a story that I wanted to tell, and also I wanted to understand for myself. And the story of 1980s Dublin, and somebody said it won't resonate with a contemporary audience, but you think of the gay marriage referendum, and then but to understand the joy of that, you have to understand the tragedy of Declan Flynn, who, like, 2 years after this play was set, was beaten to death by five youngsters in Fairview Park. And more or less, the youngsters got away with it. The judge said that they were defending the community. To understand sort of the abortion referendum, you have to understand the bitterness and the struggles that went on for those rights in a world in 1980 where divorce was an impossibility, where contraception was only just coming in with Charles Hockey's weird sort of bill, where if you had the money to go to a doctor and the doctor would write you a prescription, and then if you were looking to find a chemist, a woman could get contraceptives. And so that whole world, it seems so far removed. But if you want to understand the modern world and those docks now and all those office blocks and everything else, if you want to be a young person and understand what those referendums meant, you need to go back 40 years and look at the island they came from.
And when you go to write a play like this, Dermot, obviously you grew up in Finglas. Your father, as you say, worked in part of the docks down there. But how do you go researching it? And were they a tight-knit community? And were they happy? I mean,
I think they were happy. I think they were happy, but at the same time, they were doomed. And but this musical here was fabulous early on.
Yeah.
And you actually had one generation passing it on to another generation. In the docks, there was a sense that there were button men. They were like unionised and they had a button and they could pass that button on to their sons. And there was a sense that they had a set of skills and a great pride in their work. And they worked in dangerous and difficult conditions. And they could pass those skills on to their sons, and they all had nicknames, and the nicknames were often passed on to their sons. But by 1980, suddenly those skills are gone. Suddenly containerisation is coming in and all of those. And so I think they were tightening. There was a great rivalry and bitterness between the dockers on the North Wall and the dockers in Ring's End. The people in Ring's End shoveled coal and thought that people in the North Wall didn't do much work. And then the people in North Wall thought the Ring's Enders were affected by a condition that affects all of Southside Dublin. And so there was a bitterness. But at the same time, if any outsider criticised them, they would eat the head off. You know, there was that sense of unity. But there were also like 2,000 men at one stage all competing for a small number of jobs, and you literally would have to get up at like 7 o'clock in the morning, go down to Butbridge, see what shipping companies had ships docked, go into the pubs, try and find out information, have an enormous antennae just to know where the work was. So it was a survival of the fittest world. And I think it was, and also it was a tough world for women as well, and you never quite knew what your men earned and if your men would find work. And so I tried to tell the story of the women as much as the men.
Where did 18-year-old Dermot Bulger, who grew up in Finglas, where did you get your writing skills and your love of writing? Where did you get the confidence to think, I can be a writer?
I don't know. My father, I was looking at books last night to read in bed, and I found a copy of Sean O'Fallon's short stories given to my father for his like 70th birthday by my brother, and it was signed. And my father was a man who read at sea. My grandfather was a compositor with the Wexford Shipping Company. These men didn't have education. They didn't have a chance. They had to leave school early on. Free second level education came in. I think I'm the first generation to have that. And this is another thing in the play, the whole generation have suddenly got free second level education. And so I think, actually, to be honest with you, I think that my mother died when I was 10 years of age. And I think that when that happens to a child, you actually begin to invent a fictitious world to try and make sense of the world that's happening, because you can't really cope with the world that's happening. And I think that I began, at that moment I became a writer, because I began to invent an alternative reality for myself where there'd been a mistake, there'd been a mix-up, and my mother would be back in 6 months or 3 months. And in some ways, children do that. I've seen it with children who've had trauma. And I think that sort of out of that, I began to create fictional worlds that made sense of the real world, but weren't quite the real world.
That's incredible. The number of people, Dermot, I've interviewed who've lost a mother or father as a child, mm-hmm. and they go on to achieve great things like yourself. But it's such a profound loss. I mean, did you realise it later in your life, or were you devastated when your mother died, or was it years later that you realised the devastation?
I realised years later. I remember walking with somebody in Finglas and saying, it's funny how my mother's death didn't affect me. And they said, oh, damn it, everything about you is affected by a mother's death, has been shaped by it. And so in some ways, my childhood was fragmented in two. And in my communion photographs, I have really, really short hair and short trousers. And then my two sisters raised me. My father was away at sea, and my two sisters, and one of June, my eldest sister has become a very successful writer on the name of Laura Elliott and sells 10 times more books than me around the world and everything else. But they really took me under their wing, and my brother Roger. And so I was raised by my siblings, and that thing of having losing a mother so early, and then my own father lived to be 92 years of age, and we kept him as independent as we could. So in some ways that sort of kept us very close as a family, and we still have that closeness. And unlike so many Dublin families, we have this remarkable thing that we all still live in Dublin. But now my son lives abroad, and that thing of emigration has begun again. But I think it sort of did change us, and I think it brought us very close as a family. And I think the families in Last Orders also have that similar closeness, and they quarrel and they bicker at times, but they're very, very close to each other, and they're coming out of a world they understand.
Funny, of course, your mum would be so proud of you all if she was alive now, because you've all done so well. But like you, I was looking up, you've written, I think, probably more at this stage, Dermot, 10 collections of poetry, 14 novels, 16 plays. You set up the Raven Arts Press. You co-founded the New Ireland Books. And yet when you write a new play like this, Last Orders at the Dockside to the Abbey, are you still nervous, or are you just really confident now about your ability?
I'm actually less nervous than I used to be, because I sort of feel that this play is very different, and this play is just, you get the confidence of having ordinary people, Dubliners, coming in and saying, this is my story. And I mean, you only tell those stories to a certain limited way. But I think at 60 and three quarters, I'm too old to be nervous anymore.
Well, look, our listeners love you, Dermot. I'll bring you to, well done to Dermot for this play. I saw it on last Wednesday, and the acting and dialogue was superb. That's from Philip Joyce in Clonakilty, and brought up in Rathgar, Ballymun and Clontarf he was. And one more from Helen O'Reilly. She says, it's lovely to hear Dermot on Miriam's show. The brother and I grew up alongside him in Finglas. He's a force of nature, a powerful writer, a poet and a lovely soul. And another, David Whelan, says Dermot is a real working class hero.
And just to say that the second text of of Atla family. I mean, her brother was knighted by the Queen for his services to medicine. And so many people came out of Finglas who were so talented and such great writers and everything else. So it is something that people often overlook, the number of really interesting people who came out of that interesting world that we grew up in.
Yeah, absolutely. The Helen's brothers, he said. Well, look, Last Orders of the Dockside by you, Dermot Bulger, is on at the Abbey Theatre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival until the 26th of October. Tickets from abbeytheatre.ie. Thanks for coming in, Dermot. It's always a pleasure. We'll take a break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
In this weekend, Sunday Business Post. As Brexit remains in deadlock, Budget 2020 is the biggest challenge of Pascal Donoghue's career. We examine his options and their potential impact. Plus, can the FAI rebuild its finances? And in the magazine, Pat Kenny on the biggest scandal in Irish politics. Pick up your copy in store or subscribe at businesspost.ie.
History lovers, the past will get a whole lot more interesting between October 1st and 20th. It's the Dublin Festival of History. Join best-selling historians Young Chang, Tom Holland, Anita Anand, Dermot Ferriter, Dan Jones and many more as they discuss their chosen subject. It will also include over 150 walks, talks and seminars. Oh, by the way, everything is free. Visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie. Brought to you by Dublin City Council.
RTE, supporting the arts.
The Marion Finucane Show, this morning from 11 on RTE Radio 1.
Deirdre McGuillan, fashion editor of the Irish Times, joins me now to talk about statement jewellery and how brooches are sometimes used to send messages.
The one woman who really made brooches a political statement was Madeleine Albright. Many politicians start to look for the brooch to kind of assess what her mood might be. Like if she wore a wasp, she wanted things done speedily and fast. If she thought she was being bugged by the Russians, she wore a bug on her lapel.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, where even the little things make all the difference. Tesco, every little helps.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
And our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can also find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Callaghan. If you were watching the Eurovision 1994 and you thought the interval was the ideal time to pop out and put the kettle on, big mistake, because you would have missed a verifiable phenomenon, which was, of course, Riverdance. Featuring dancers Jean Butler and Michael Flatley, singers Anuna and Ireland's very best traditional dancers, the entire Point Depot jumped to its feet in ovation. The music, however, was by my next guest this morning, the one and only Bill Whelan. And he's here today to talk about a new studio recording of Riverdance to mark 25 years. And there's going to be a special concert next February, 25 years to the day after the full-length show, which has crisscrossed this world several times over. Good morning, Bill Whelan.
Good morning.
Oh, lovely to see you.
And lovely to see you, Miriam.
Go back to that night, actually, Eurovision 94. Were you nervous?
I was very nervous. Not alone that, but I was seated in the studio, or at least in the Point, and there was this woman beside me, or in the next seat, a couple of seats away, with blonde hair and a daughter in a communion dress. Would you have remembered anything like that?
That was me and Alana, yeah.
It was amazing. An incredible night, yeah. Wasn't it? And I think, like, for those of us who were involved in it, I think the big thing was to try and just relax and hope that, you know, it was live television. There were all those dancers. There was Flatley and Butler, drummers, Anuna, you know, so many things, the live orchestra. You know, so many things could, you know, have gone perhaps a little sideways, but it was just a perfect performance. And then when we looked around and saw the entire Point on its feet and everybody waving their national flags, we really got a hint then that something special had happened. Even though we did suspect, you know, when we saw it in rehearsal and stuff, we knew it was good and we knew that, you know, we had good hopes for it. But, you know, as you know yourself, it's when it happens is what counts.
How did you, as the composer, set about writing that music? How did you do that?
Well, the idea was that the Eurovision was being positioned in the at the Point Theatre, as it was then, and on the river. So there was a sort of a river theme running throughout the whole notion of the production by Moya Doherty. And I just came up with an idea for how this piece of music would run. It would begin very quietly, like a river begins at the source, with Anuna singing the piece I wrote for them, and then introduce Jean, and then the Flatley figure. And as the river headed towards the sea, it grows in intensity, it grows in size, and the whole thing, the whole Riverdance piece is based on a music that's very dynamic and starts very quietly and builds to a climax. And that's really what I set about doing. And then, of course, I tried as much as possible to write pieces which were interesting to dance to. So, for instance, when the Riverdance theme comes in after Michael Flatley's entrance, you know, I tried to mix the rhythms a little bit so that it wasn't just regular Irish jigs and reels. It was split time, which was mixed, you know, which gave a challenge to the dancers, but actually made it all more fun for all of us at the end.
Because it was regarded and is regarded as radical. But I think I read something you said that it was radical in terms of Irish dancing. Mm. You changed that forever, but that Irish music had been developing.
Well, I believe that, you know, guys like, you know, composers and performers like myself and others have at that generation of who came up through the 60s and 70s, you know, Planxty were there. We'd already had O'Riordan and then the Chieftains. And there was a sort of development. There was an excitement about Irish music that was happening. And there were key figures like Donal Lunny and Andy Irvine and all these folks who were really introducing, you know, an interesting take on Irish music, which made it accessible to a much wider audience and to a younger audience. Suddenly it was kind of Irish music was becoming something that was not just, you know, situated in rural pubs. It was like this was in concert halls. And so I think that development was going on all through the 60s and 70s, 80s. And then dance sort of resided over in the competition culture. So, you know, the all the various dance competitions, you danced to a standard which were judged. And what Riverdance did, I think, was it turned the dance around and faced the audience. And it became a piece of theatre as opposed to just something that you were marked on by the steps that you did and stuff. And I think that was probably, I always think of it as the developments in Irish music and the development in Irish dance kind of kissed at that moment, that they met. And then there's been all kinds of things, obviously, since then.
But created by all of you involved. Did that night change your life?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's no point in saying anything else. It was dramatic, the change that. And I was just talking to my wife yesterday about, you know, reflecting back on the time. And it happened at such a rate. It was so fast. Suddenly we moved from this, you know, thing in the Point to, you know, we had a number one hit single for 18 weeks. All kinds of things started to happen that you never even dreamed of. But then the big impetus was to write a full 2-hour show. And that's what I had to set down to do. And Moya Doherty and I toured around Europe. We went to, I decided that I would try to work with music that I had already in some way engaged with. So Spanish music, Eastern European music, and make the whole river journey being about a journey throughout the various forms. So we went off down to Seville and we went to Eastern Europe. And eventually I sat down to write it in October of 94.
Okay.
And then we opened in February 95. So there wasn't much sleeping, Miriam.
I was just going to say. And was there a moment, and that became so successful, the full show, was there a moment when you sat back and you thought, oh my goodness?
I lay back. I actually remember the moment. We had opened in Radio City Music Hall in New York, and everything was so hectic and so frantic up to then that I don't think any of us really had a chance to digest it. I remember coming back from a rehearsal in Radio City and I just lay out in the bed in the afternoon and I remember looking at the ceiling. I can remember this moment. And suddenly the scale of this whole thing sort of dropped in on me. It was incredible.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
And there was a pub in Limerick, wasn't there, that used to tell us about that?
Yeah, there was a pub in Limerick that used to play after the Angelus, appropriately, of course.
Every day.
I think before the Angelus, they would put on a DVD, a VHS, actually,
yes,
of Riverdance every afternoon.
I love it.
And everyone sort of toasted it and stuff. Obviously, my Limerick connection was being celebrated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What is your own background? Where did you get your musical ability? What was your background growing
up? It's interesting listening to Dermot talking about parents and stuff. You know, my dad died when I was quite young. I was 21. But he had brought so much music into the house that I was exposed to a lot of music through him. And then my mother was a very fine musician. She was a great pianist. So, you know, we did have a tradition in the house of hearing music, playing music, people coming in. So I grew up listening to it quite a lot. I was a little bit of a desultory kind of music student. I wanted to do my own thing. I knew I loved it. I loved every moment I sat at the piano and played. But I did. I went to piano teachers. I actually learned the violin, which we don't talk about. And then when I went through college, when I came out of college, I went straight into the music business, playing in pits and Jesus Christ Superstar, all kinds of things, and then became, you know, I learned, and it's very interesting, I often talk about this, the role that RTE played in the careers of people like me, where we were freelancers, but there was always, RTE was making programs then. It was making music programs, light entertainment programs, so there was lots of work for us either as musicians, and I learned a lot about orchestration, about, you know, arranging everything, just through working with people like Noel Keelahan and all the people who were employed here on the staff.
Yeah.
We were kind of given a gift of a university in a way that...
That's great. It was.
Yeah, it was a curious education because there were things about it maybe that an academic education wouldn't approach, but then there were things about it that you needed to survive as a working musician.
And interestingly, because Dermot obviously spoke about the death of his mother and you were saying you were 21 when your dad died. And funny enough, on Friday, I was with Mick McCarthy, the Ireland manager, at an event. And he was beside me and he was speaking about the death publicly of his own mother, almost for the first time when he was 24. And he was reflecting and thinking how profound it was in his own life and the life of his siblings. Losing your father at 21, was that profound for you?
It was. And I had a very similar moment to the one I spoke about earlier in New York, where months and months, you know, my mother and my father, there were just three of us. I was an only child. So my mother and father, we lived in Limerick. They had a shop. I worked in the shop. I went to school. But, you know, it wasn't until I had to kind of hold it together for my mother after my dad died. for a while. And then I just remember one day I had exactly that kind of moment where suddenly my father missing from my life just hit me. And I just remember, just breaking down. It was really profoundly affecting. And it just makes you realize how much goes on in your subconscious that you're trying to deal with all the time, but you don't. You have to do the other stuff. Mm. And then there comes a moment when the subconscious said, OK, it's my time now.
It's interesting also, I didn't know you were an only child. I have a theory, probably wrong, that only children are often really high achievers.
Really?
And then other people who have an only child worry that their child is lonely because they're an only child. What was your experience of being an only
child?
A bit of both.
I mean, I did certainly benefit from the sort of, you know, I didn't have to share too many things. When music was brought into the house, there were my LPs that I could play, and I didn't have my sister looking to listen to Cliff
Steal
Richard
them.
Or something, or my brother fighting me for Frank Zappa. You know, it was interesting. I felt in many ways that I had the benefit of that special attention, but I also had moments of loneliness when. You know, other kids were off doing things and I didn't have a brother to fight with or, you know, it's interesting. But you do spend a lot of solitary time and you do spend a lot of time working on, you know, I was able to develop my ability, I think, to write tunes. I spent a lot of time at the piano. On my own.
And that's obviously worked brilliantly. You're going to play a clip or two because Riverdance, the 25th anniversary show, is going to be at the Three Arena from the 6th to the 9th of February. Mm-hmm. What clip are you going to play for us from?
Well, actually, it's a little story about this.
Yeah.
Because I went to hear a piece of music. There were actually a concert run by Music Network, really terrific concert with a classical mandolin player called Avi Avital and a classical accordion player called Ksenia Sidorova. And they played a beautiful selection of Vivaldi and Mozart and stuff. It was a fantastic concert. And we went afterwards and said hi. And then we went and had a drink and we're chatting. And he said to me, he was Jewish. And he said to me, you know, Bill, when I was 13, I was living in a kibbutz in the desert in Israel, he said, and somebody gave me a copy of the Riverdance CD. And he said, you know, I learned all the tunes. He said, I had a tape recorder and I was running the tape back and forth and learning the tunes. He said, I learned every tune on the Riverdance CD when he was 13.
Incredible.
And I said, my God. I said, Avi, if I ever get to do it again, I said, I'm going to ring you. And he said, oh, I definitely do. So then when the proposal came up for the 25th anniversary to do a re-record of the score, I rang Avi. And Avi is playing, there's a piece in Riverdance called Fire Dance, and Avi plays the mandolin on it, and we're going to play that now.
It's so nice you remembered him, actually. It's so nice you did call him up.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was delighted to have him. I mean, he was fantastic. And like so many of the musicians who were on this new album, you know, many of them, unfortunately, weren't even born. I say this unfortunately from my own point of view, but they weren't even born when I was writing it. So now they were bringing a new kind of a new take on the music. And this is Avi playing the mandolin and Fire Dance.
Thank you.
Avi.
That's Avi. Wonderful. I mean, the reach of everyone's just lots of reaction to you, Bill. But just to say, Hugh in Dublin 8 says, Miriam, Bill Whelan is a musical genius. I think Riverdance played a great role in boosting and igniting a new confidence in Irishness. The success of our writers, our footballers, musicians like you two became world success stories. Our economy in many ways followed. To Bill, Moya and John, congrats. Your success has been our success, which is lovely. I mean, before we go, Bill, the reach of Riverdance.
Yeah, that extraordinary across the 25 years, so many things happened. There were almost too many of them. And you know, I've got to meet all kinds of people, and all of us have got to meet people that we wouldn't have expected ever to meet, like Xi Jinping from China. You know, we did a special performance for him, and Bill Clinton, and obviously all of the political leaders. And then I got to meet a lot of my musical heroes, which was fantastic. Quincy Jones presented me with my Grammy. So that was a big moment for me.
Incredible, yeah.
But one that I will definitely carry to my grave is we were playing in Tokyo, and I was put sitting with the then Crown Prince Naruhito of Japan, because he played the viola in the court orchestra in Japan. So I was put sitting with him. Fantastic, very educated man, spoke perfect English. We got talking, and he said, you know, the instruments are amazing, the pipes. And he said, I'd love to see those. And I said, oh, well, so I'm sure we can arrange that. So at the interval, I went back to Julian Erskine and I said, listen, the Crown Prince would like to meet the musicians. So there was a massive diplomatic flurry to arrange this meeting. And I will carry to my grave the image of the next emperor of Japan, Emperor Naruhito, getting a tutorial in the Bowron from Johnny McDonough.
That's such a great image. Just to say, I've got to bring, nice to hear Bill talking about growing up in Limerick, Miriam. My grandparents had a dairy in Thomas Street, and I'd go to Bill's parents' shop with my granny when I was small. His mum would always give me chocolate, which is lovely. That's from Karen. Another Breed says, Miriam, Riverdance for me will always be that split second of silence before the point arrives. Erupted. And one more says, Miriam, I saw Riverdance live in 94. One of those moments you were proud to be Irish, seeing our music and dance displayed in such a fashion after all. Bill Whelan, thanks so much for coming in. Riverdance, the 25th anniversary show. It's going to be on at the Three Arena from the 6th to the 9th of February next year. And tickets are going on sale this Thursday, the 10th of October at 9 a.m. Bill Whelan, thanks so much for coming in, and congrats on all your great success.
Thank you.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
You know, consulting firms are like onions. Layer after layer after layer after layer. You just don't get the answer or the person you need. You just get irritation. Ugh. Ready for an approach with less bureaucracy? Welcome to Grant Thornton Audit Tax and Advisory. It's not status quo, it's status go.
Welcome back indoors to the all-new furniture and accessories range at Homebase, with hundreds of new pieces to choose from. Homebase, feels good to be home.
History lovers, the past will get a whole lot more interesting between October 1st and 20th. It's the Dublin Festival of History. Join best-selling historians Young Chang, Tom Holland, Anita Anand, Dermot Ferreter, Dan Jones and many more as they discuss their chosen subject. It will also include over 150 walks, talks and seminars. Oh, by the way, everything is free. Visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie. Brought to you by Dublin City Council.
RTE, supporting the arts.
The Ray D'Arcy Show, weekdays from 3 on RTE Radio 1.
So as class has opened up the world of technology to you,
yes,
Phyllis?
All of that's open to me now, where before I didn't know any of that.
Did you see the birth of a grandchild?
Oh, I did. Wasn't that amazing? My son in Australia, his wife was expecting a baby. My husband and I were part of this, sitting up in bed in Dublin. From the delivery room, this baby had been born, and we're watching him cutting the umbilical cord. Now that is the beauty of the internet. Yes.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand, who recently welcomed 17 new pharmacies to the All Care family.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
And Martha Dunley texts to say, proof that I'm 100%, I just got goosebumps when they played a snippet of Riverdance on Miriam's show 25 years on. Well, welcome back, Moya Brennan. Earlier on this morning, you were here. You sang beautifully live with your husband, Tim, your son, Paul, and daughter, Ashton, who are all here with you this morning. Paul's birthday. Happy birthday to you again, Paul. And obviously, you've going and have gone from strength to strength, Moya. And tell us first, though, you've got a concert next Friday, and it's for a charity you're involved in. Tell me about that.
Well, I've been involved with the CBM for 15 years. It's about blindness, but they do an awful lot more with disability. And I've had the privilege of actually being in a lot of places in Africa, Rwanda, the Congo, and Tanzania, Kenya, also in South America and Central America. And I've seen their amazing work. And people kind of mightn't, know CBM, Christian Blind Mission, because they don't kind of go in and put up their own stall. It's kind of they get involved with established hospitals or churches, whether it's Catholic, Protestant, and so they train people. They create kind of even a small sort of factory to make prosthetics and chairs for cerebral palsy kids. And it's just incredible what they do. And they, do craft kind of play things for them to develop their skills. And it's just amazing, amazing. So, I'm so behind it. And it's just wonderful to be involved with them. So yeah. This concert is the because it's about blindness as well. We thought it would be a nice concept that it would be a concert more about hearing rather than seeing. So there's going to be very little light. And it's really about sitting back and enjoying the music. So, and it's very diverse. And it's like, it's going to be wonderful because it's going to start with the organist of Christ Church Cathedral playing a piece of music. So that'll be the set,
Beautiful.
After there's a little exhibition as well of like seeing what the work that they do
And it's in Christ Church Cathedral, next Friday.
Yes.
And you've Finbar Fury, Paul Byrum, African Gospel Choir, lots of lineup as well.
It's fantastic. Well, there again, it's about the different sounds. So I got a variety of different kind of sounds, like especially like Paul being a wonderful tenor, then Finbar, who he is, it's just like lovely. I love listening to his voice. And just then the African gospel singers. It'll be really special. I'm really looking forward to it.
And I've been lucky to interview you down the years. I even got up to the pub in Gweedore and got your great dad, Leo. Yeah, what a beautiful man. What a beautiful place. But there's something else you want to talk about this morning, isn't there, Moya?
Well, it's something that I was diagnosed with over 2 years ago. And, my family are aware of it and everything. And, when you're diagnosed with something that's kind of, you don't say fatal because I could have a lot of years. You've no control over it. It's called pulmonary fibrosis. It's scarring of the lungs and it grows. You don't want to talk about it at the beginning because you kind of don't want that pity but now it's just like I was along with actually Magella O'Donnell the other day and we were just talking about what she did and everything. And it's good to kind of share with people, especially people that might have a similar illness is to do with the lungs, and just to show that you just can get on and be up about it, and it's not doom and gloom. Yeah. So it's nice to share with people. But I realise that here I am as a singer, and my breathing is going to go on me. And it's, as I said, no control over it. But I have met people that have lived quite a long time with it, and I've also met people that it's sort of, as I said, it could be shorter or longer, but here I am going out on a Clannad tour next year.
Yeah, a big long tour.
I'm doing a lot with myself as well. I'm doing a short Irish tour in November with my family and also Cormac DeBarra and beautiful fiddle player, Leah Wright. So I'm doing a couple of concerts around Ireland, like Matt Malloy's and Carrick and Shannon and Roisin Dhu and Gweedore as well.
Gweedore.
And so doing that. But in February, we're going out to do a farewell tour. And it is a farewell tour.
There'll be lots of farewell tours by
then. Well, I definitely know that it's going to be a farewell tour.
For
Clannad. And it's going to take us around the world. Live Nation are going to take us all around the world. So it's going to be sort of, it'll probably take about a year and a bit to get to most places, and but it'll be nice to do. And Aisling and Paul are actually in the band with Clannad now as well, so it's wonderful to be on. You know, when I was away all those times and away, maybe missing special school events and the odd birthday here and there, and now they're with me.
Yeah, it was great on his birthday as well.
That's even special. Yeah.
And does it make you almost appreciate life more? I often wonder that. You know, as you're going to be the person who's going to live the extra 30 years, right, Moya Brennan? You are that, those people. But does it make you, when you get a diagnosis like that, initially very concerned and then determined to really appreciate your life more?
You do. And, you know, it was a shock at the beginning because I knew there was something up. And then when my husband, Tim, he was with me at the time, and we both kind of, we didn't, you know, expect the results that it was pulmonary fibrosis. And but it does make you look at life differently, and you sort of, you know, you cherish everything, and you kind of, you know, I mean, I was kind of always a bit healthy, but I'm even more healthier now, and kind of just doing a lot of things, being aware of things, you know, and how precious family is. And, you know, and I'm not doom and gloom, you know, as I said, I'm not down about it at all. I'm kind of quite up. It's maybe very positive. And it's singing is great for the lungs. Yep. It's a good physio for the lungs. So I'll keep on singing as long as I can.
And it's great as well, I suppose. You have your own family here, but you come from such a big family, don't
I do.
You? And I suppose at times of crisis or difficulty, that really comes into play.
It does, you know, when you've got four sisters and four brothers, and it's amazing.
Where do you come in it, by the way? Where do you come in that list?
I'm the eldest. Yeah. I'm the big sister. And, you know, you've always got that support, and it's fantastic. And, you know, there have been loads of times that every one of them have been on stage. We've been together on stage, or, you know, some of my sisters have been with Clannad on stage. And you know, when I'm there in the pub or whatever, and Bartley will be singing and Dawn will be singing. We all kind of, we just grew up with a lot of love and music in the house, and it was a normal thing. So, you know.
Yeah, but real privilege though, isn't it, to have a house so musical? And actually, I was asking Bill Whelan there about being an only child, what it's like being the eldest of nine, is it?
Yes.
Does it make you a very responsible person? Do you get sick of minding all your siblings?
Yeah, you ended up, you know, sort of looking after the second half of the family in a way. But no, you never get sick of it. But, you know, I boss them about sometimes.
Do you still?
Know. But no. But they kind of look at me a little bit. You know, if there's advice or something like that, they will kind of come to me and share things with me and everything. And it's really nice. And we're all very close, which is really, really special. And that's probably the strongest thing of all, having a family that's really close. And we look out for each other, and because there's so many of us, there's always an anniversary or special birthday or a wedding or a christening or something going on. So we're you know, any excuse and we're together.
You'll never be lonely, Annie.
No way.
You have to dream of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you're looking for, when you go out now for the next 2 years in Clannad, you had such a success with Clannad. Do you think you'll enjoy it even more now with Clannad?
I think, you know, we've sort of been doing the odd gigs here and there in the last couple of years, but it's kind of now that we've looked at it, and BMG have come in and they're doing an anthology, kind of big sort of vinyl and CD and a big book and everything. And it's kind of, it's lovely to look at it as a finale kind of thing. And we're looking at doing this show and looking forward to it. Yeah, very, very much so. And probably because of it's the In a Lifetime farewell tour, and, you know, it's meant an awful lot to us. It's been amazing. It's an amazing journey. And, you know, and we really cherish every minute of the tour.
And just before you sing for us again, I'm lucky, just to explain to my listeners, because I'm sitting looking at you. By the way, you look super healthy, Moya.
Thank you
look
you
fantastic.
Very much.
But I'm also looking at your son, Paul, whose birthday it is today, and your daughter, Aisling. Both looking, actually, it's quite moving with great love for you. But most of all, Tim. I've interviewed you a good few times down the years, and Tim is always by your side.
Always.
This is your husband.
Yes.
And credit where credit is due. How important has he been through the tough times?
I wouldn't be me without Tim all my life, like as far as even with the kids, with supporting me, everything. He's my total rock behind me, and I certainly wouldn't be where I am and who I am and everything about me without him, for sure, you know.
Yeah.
He's my other half.
Yeah, no, he really is. He's always quiet, but he is actually playing the cello today.
He is indeed, yeah.
Yeah, which is lovely.
Yeah.
And finally, Moya, let's say happy birthday to Paul, your son.
Why not?
Yeah. Go.
No, it's not. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear boy. Happy birthday to you.
Great. I promised I'd embarrass him, you see, so that was good.
There you go.
Now you're going to sing us that. What song are you going to sing for us now?
A song that was on my last album that I wrote and performed with Aisling and Paul particularly. And there was one, you know, I didn't go out to, my father passed away 3 years ago and I didn't go out to write a song about him. But as you know, he was a man of many songs and everything. So River of Songs was the song that came about. But it was, I was doing New Year's Eve, the year he passed away, I was doing New Year's Eve in Leo's Tavern, and I do that now every year and I love it. But there was a moment and I just felt his presence, and the line came into my head with, "Now I know you've never left at all." And it was just, I knew he was with me all the time, and just that line, I couldn't wait to go into the studio and create the song kind of nearly around that line. So it's called River of Songs.
Oh, Moya, thank you so much. And thanks so much for coming in today. I've only time for a little bit of reaction, lots of beautiful reaction to you. Oh, Miriam, what a wonderful sound from Moya and family. Moya has me all emotional. Thank you. That's from Anne in Port Leash. And another says, Neon Gray, I hope she a lovely hearing the lovely and very talented Moya on Miriam. She comes from such a talented musical family, from Leo and Baba to Clonid and now a new generation. Love them all and best of luck to Moya going forward. Okay, my thanks and sound today to Ciarán Dunn. Denise Davies was our BCO. The show is produced by Sian O'Gorman. We're going to go out listening to the wonderful Moya Brennan, accompanied by her daughter Aisling, son Paul and husband Tim. Have a great Sunday. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. That was such a treat. That was so beautiful. Thanks to Moya and all your family. Just to say, the tickets for your concert next Friday the 11th in Christchurch are on sale from concertinthedark.ie. And finally, the winner of our Celine Dion tickets is Pauline Clooney in Newbridge in Kildare. Congrats, Pauline. That's all from us for today. Slán.